All right, we're going to return to our study of Acts, where we left Paul in a riot scene at the end of chapter 22. But as I went through the following passage and the things that happened next, I began to think about another chapter where the Lord gave instructions as to what was going to happen to us in this world and how to deal with it. And connecting the two, one can see in the way that Paul conducted himself an illustration of what the Lord Jesus told us, how he told us to respond. I've thought about calling my series on Acts. If I called it anything, I'd probably call it the playbook. Because as I read through it, what I've seen in each place is the how-to of conducting ourselves in the world. It is true we live in a very different world, but we have the same Lord. We also have the same enemy. And in many ways, the challenges that we face are going to be, they're going to look different, but they're going to be inwardly very similar to the things that the early Christians, when the New Testament was being written, faced. So I want to start in Matthew 10 on verse 16, where Jesus is instructing the disciples who he's sending out on mission for the first time. And he says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to councils and scourge you in their synagogues. You will be brought before governors and kings for my sake, as a testimony to them and to the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak, for it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father who speaks in you." We won't get to this part today, but it is a little bit interesting to note that after what happens to him here, Paul is interrogated by Felix and Agrippa. And Felix is a governor and Agrippa is a king. So the Lord said, "You will be brought before governors and kings and also will be beaten in the synagogues." And all three of those things happened to Paul within a very short span of time. And as we continue that incident later, we will see that, but we do not have time to get through that whole story today. So hopefully everybody was paying attention when Zach preached through Matthew 10 about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago. He called it Six Rules for Infiltrators. If you're taking notes, maybe that's what your notes would be under, hopefully. So I'm not going to re-preach that, but I want to recap what Jesus tells us about what our expectations should be as we go out into the world. He tells us we are sheep in the midst of wolves. Well, there is a great inherent power disparity between a sheep and a wolf. Is Zach, you may recall, talked about the sheep trying to go one-on-one with a wolf. The sheep will lose 10 times out of 10. The wolf is equipped to fight that way. The sheep is not. Similarly, if we go out and we try to be wolves in the world, either one, we will just lose and get devoured, or two, we will succeed and we will become what we're fighting against. So if you go out and you try to sock it to them with carnal weapons and fight against the world and the flesh instead of the spiritual battle that we're called to, then we either lose or we become the world. There's not another way to get around it. Zach called this fighting the wrong war. That's something that really stuck with me. We are not here to win our rights for the purpose of having our rights or to have a convenient life or to make sure people don't say bad things about us or don't take advantage of us in any way. That is a war you can fight if you want to, but it is not the one that we're called to fight. The war we're called to fight is a spiritual one, first against the darkness in here, and then against the darkness out there. And that darkness is not a human person. It is the force that holds captive people who serve because they must until they're set free and have the choice not to. So he warns us, you won't have carnal power. If you go up and try to duke it out with the wolves, you'll just lose. Or you'll become it. You'll become the wolves. And then he tells us that our witness is always going to be rejected by the world in general. But he also tells us that sometimes it will be rejected by people we would think are on our team. So when he says you will be beaten in the synagogues, he's talking to Jews. It is very much like if he were to say to us, you will be run out of the churches. Now, we do not expect to be run out of churches if they believe biblically. But for Jews, the synagogue was what the church would be to us, only more so. So what he was saying was, you will be rejected by people who should receive you. Where your expectation of the world might be, yeah, the world's the wolves, I know they won't receive me. But here in the synagogue, you know, they shouldn't. When Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, surely if you just explain it right, I think Paul struggled with this his entire life, trying to explain it just right so that they wouldn't act like this. And it never worked because there was a bigger plan going on. And human nature is just very, very wicked and very strange sometimes. People do not act the way they should, and expectations can really mess us up, and that's something we're going to look at in the story today as we get into that. So to handle all of these things, Jesus tells us that we need to be two things in balance. We need to be wise, and we need to be harmless. Harmless could also mean guileless, without deceit, a person who is not known for sneaking and conniving or being devious, but a person who's known for being straightforward and simple, but not foolish. Straightforwardness and simple and simplicity, thank you, and simplicity are good qualities. Foolishness is not a quality that the Lord wants us to have. And he actually promises to provide us with wisdom. In James, he says, if you lack it, ask for it, but without wavering. Be willing to do steadfastly whatever the Lord says, and he'll give you wisdom to do it. And he tells us that if we are these things, then even when we are opposed, the opposition will turn to the further spreading of our witness. He says it will turn to you for a testimony. So let's go back with that, this in mind. This is the playbook that Jesus gave his disciples. And this is how it was applied in Acts 22, starting on verse 23. Now to recap, Paul just gave his testimony to the crowd. There wasn't anything wrong with the testimony. There was something wrong with the crowd. About the time he got to ministry to the Gentiles, they started yelling, "Away with this person from the earth, for he is not fit to live." And the narrator says, "Then as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that he might know why they shouted so against him. And as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?' And the centurion heard that. He went and told the commander, saying, 'Take care what you do, for this man is a Roman.' And the commander came and said to him, 'Tell me, are you a Roman?' He said, 'Yes.' The commander answered, 'With a large sum I obtained this citizenship.' And Paul said, 'But I was born a citizen.' Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out he was a Roman and because he had bound him." So for anyone who doesn't know, the Roman world was not like our world. In America, typically if you live here, unless you came here from somewhere else, you are a citizen. Just by being born here, in fact, even if your parents weren't citizens, you are automatically a citizen. And even if you're not a citizen, you still have most of the same protections under the law that citizens have. So you could be visiting here, but you can't just be rousted and thrown in jail without charges, even though you're not a citizen, because that's not the way things work. Rome was a dual-layer society, so you had citizens up here who could vote and who had rights, and you had everybody else down here, and then you had slaves. Actually, that's three layers, but slaves aren't relevant to what I'm talking about here. And the non-citizen block was the most common block of people, and they had very few rights. And one thing that you could do if you were a person charged with keeping peace in a province, their whole idea, the Romans' whole idea, was to quash the disorder. They did not care about individual rights. They didn't value human life, especially if it was non-citizen life. The whole idea was to make the noise stop and implement what they call the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, which made the world a fairly orderly, stable place at the time, but did not give much regard to the individual. One thing that they would do, and this was common practice, was if somebody was arrested, to find out whether or not they were guilty, they were guilty, they would flog them before, as an initial component of the questioning. So there was no justice in this. There was no regard for human rights. There was no nothing. It was just a way that they thought got results. You flog somebody, and then hopefully they tell you whatever they know. This is something that the Romans did quite often, but it was not something the Jews did. The Jews had their own little justice system that operated inside the Roman justice system. And in John 7:51, a guy named Nicodemus, who's a member of their court, says, "You know, remember, guys, we don't judge anyone until we hear the case. So we never hand down a judgment without hearing the case first. This is, no one argues with them. This is an immutable fact of Jewish law. They don't do this. They don't go around like a bunch of pagan Romans beating people before they find out the facts. So just put your finger on that. We're going to get to that in a minute." So citizens if they were tried and found guilty, could still be beheaded, which is actually what happened to Paul at the end of his life. They couldn't be crucified or tortured or anything like that. They had some rights. And if you did mistakenly beat or even imprison a citizen without charges, you were in big, big trouble. And the Romans, I don't know what the penalty was for that, but the Romans didn't know how to do anything small. It was probably the death penalty, I don't know. So we see, if you were with us in Acts 16, we saw how Paul and Silas were beaten and thrown in jail. Silas was also a Roman citizen, and they really scared the mayor, who was responsible, by telling him, hey, you just beat us and threw us in jail, and guess what? We're citizens. And if they went and complained to the higher authorities, that guy would have been in big trouble. The interesting thing is, they didn't tell him, they didn't tell the magistrates of Philippi that they were citizens until after the fact, when they kind of had the goods. He told the commander up front. Well, one possible explanation for this, the commentators propose, is that there was just too much going on, too much noise during the riot at Philippi, and they couldn't communicate with the magistrates to let them know they were making a big mistake. My personal pet theory is that they deliberately allowed themselves to be flogged and thrown in prison, so that they would leave, they would have something on the magistrates, and thereafter the local government would leave the Christians alone. The Bible doesn't say that's what they were doing, but it sounds like them to me, to try to leave some protection in place so the church could prosper and not be bothered by the local authorities. So Paul waits until they have bound him, which is, that is a boo-boo right there. It might not be a death penalty offense, but you're in trouble if you bound a Roman citizen without charges. But before they flogged him, which would have crossed a much bigger line, is a very intelligent way to deal with the situation. So what do we see here? Jesus said, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Is Paul being manipulative here because he uses the system? He uses his rights as a citizen? No, he's being very straightforward. He's not being devious. No one's going to say, oh, that Paul's a sneaky dog. He just has rights, and he brings them up at the appropriate time so that the situation works in his favor according to what he has available to work with. He is being wise, and he's also being harmless. He's not threatening. He didn't send word up the chain and say, hey, if I get one lash, you're going to get crucified. I'll see to you. He didn't do that. He just let them know, guess what? I am a citizen. This is really kind of illegal what you're doing here. So obviously, not everybody who was in the early church had Roman citizenship. A lot of people were tortured without a trial and killed in terrible ways. And if you lived back then, you might kind of look at Paul and Silas with a little bit of envy and say, well, that must be nice to be able to get out of things by just whipping out your Roman citizenship card. And there I think we need to remember, the Bible says that God makes us differ from each other. So he gives some of us the opportunity to have more freedom. Like, today I'm preaching in our church. I do not expect I will be in prison for 9 years tomorrow. There's a brother in China right now who's starting a 9-year prison sentence for doing exactly the same thing I'm doing right now. I'm sure I wouldn't trade lots with him. I doubt he would trade lots with me, because the Lord gives us what we need. Like Paul, for example, people might have appreciated having his Roman citizenship, but I don't think they'd have wanted the rest of his resume with all his floggings, beatings, drownings, etc. The Lord makes us differ from each other. And some of us will have opportunities that others do not have. But only the Lord knows how they are balanced in each life with the things maybe that no one else knows. In 1 Corinthians 7:21, Paul tells us, he's talking to servants. He says, if you are a servant, don't worry. You can still serve God. You don't have to be politically free. You don't have to have personal liberty in order to serve God. But then he adds, however, if you can get freedom, go ahead. So he's telling slaves, because in the Roman world, if you were a slave, you could work your way up sometimes. If you happen to have the opportunity, you could earn money on the side, one day you might have enough to buy your freedom out. And he's telling them, do that. Why? Well, Galatians 5:13, he says, do not use your liberty. He's talking about Christian liberty. We can apply this to regular liberty too, or outward liberty. Do not use it for the flesh. Do not use it to satisfy the desires of your flesh, but instead use it to serve one another by love. And I think that's what Paul was doing at Philippi, when instead of using his freedom as a Roman citizen to save himself, he used it to set up safeguards for the local church as it will, if one interprets as you will, if one interprets the passage that way. Here, that situation is not present. He had the opportunity to use his freedom to avoid getting beaten up and knocked out of action for a while. He did so. He's again being wise. So, resuming on verse 30, the next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, this is referring to the commander, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, lurking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by to strike him on the mouth. And Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law?" And those who stood by said, "Do you revile God's high priest?" Then Paul said, "I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" So a little bit about Ananias. High priest at this time was not as much of an exalted spiritual office as it had been. It was more of a political office. Some people during a recent era had tried to be priest and king at the same time. The priests had become political leaders. Some were good and some were bad. Ananias was a very, very bad man. He was famous for sending his thugs armed with clubs to steal the tithes from the priests, which left them with no livelihood, so that he could keep all the goodies for himself. He was a collaborator with Rome. He had people assassinated. And he actually was, eventually, within probably about 10 years of these of this incident, he was assassinated himself by the Jews, by the Zealot movement, which Josephus remarks was a just consequence for him because he had not hesitated to have others assassinated. So Paul's words here, "God will strike you," were fulfilled. So he was speaking the truth. He was not just blowing up. It was a true statement. Some people think that the way he reacts, saying, "Punch that guy in the face," is because there's no way he could say, "I have lived before God in all good conscience." He had all sorts of sins that hadn't been dealt with on his conscience. And corruption hates to be in the face of righteousness. Paul had lived a very upright life, and he was appealing that to the Jews, who knew it was true, to try to tell them, "Okay, you know that I have lived a life of good conscience." But they didn't react the way he expected. So when you hit somebody in the mouth in the Middle East, I think in America we sort of tend to do that because their mouth is there, and probably because that's what they offended us with, if we're in a some sort of fist fight. In the Middle East, it is a statement that says, "Shut up." So what they were essentially saying was, "Shut up, you're guilty. We don't need any evidence, we don't need your testimony, we already know you're guilty, so just be quiet." This is absolutely opposite to what Jewish law calls for. Remember, Romans flog people before they get the facts. But the law, the Jewish law, does not judge anyone until there has been an investigation. This is not a Jewish thing to do. So we very rarely see Paul get mad in the New Testament. He does sometimes with the sorcerer and the girl at Philippi. Here, though, he really seems to have acted impetuously, and as far as I'm aware, this is the only thing he ever apologized for that he said or did. So why is he mad? Why is the guy who preached patient endurance, he wrote so much about endurance under persecution, why does he snap back at these guys just like anybody else? Why is he not able to do what he's holding up for us that everyone should be doing? Well, something I learned a long time ago that I was able to apply to my life is that most of the time when we get mad, it's because our expectations weren't met. You take Paul, the Romans had beaten him many times already, and would again, I'm sure. And they had been getting ready to do something much worse than punch him in the face, but he's totally calm as a cucumber in the face of that. He just says to the guy, "Hey, bro, this is illegal." But with him, he immediately snaps back with, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall." And he immediately has to not retract the words, but to say, "Yeah, I wasn't thinking, that's right. The law tells us we should not say that to the high priest." Well, I think it was because it was unmet expectations. His expectation of the Jews was that they would act more fairly. This is where we have to watch out. When we have any expectation on somebody, if they do not meet it, then we'll probably be mad. So we have to be very careful what expectation we put on them and not expect them to act in a manner that is inconsistent with what we know about them. You might have seen this coming since Jesus said we would be beaten in the synagogues, or they would be. I guess we probably won't be, but his Jewish followers were. But he seems to have had a blind spot when it comes to the Jews and always wanted to think the best about them, even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. So here's some encouragement. If Paul can say something impetuously that he regrets, then that could probably happen to anybody. Now, that is not license, but it does let us know that we can recover. We can even immediately recover because we see what he does next. Now, before we get to that, I want to answer the question of why Paul says, I didn't realize he was the high priest. Paul surely was not so ignorant of the affairs of his nation and the identity of the current high priest or his presentation as the leader in the meeting that they were in, that he literally did not know that Ananias was the high priest. Some have suggested Ananias was a usurper and Paul was was sarcastically alluding to the lack of legitimacy to his being the high priest. To me, though, the way that makes the most sense to me, if you walked through the streets of Bolivar and you saw somebody mugging somebody in an alley, and it was Mike Parson who was doing the mugging, he's, the governor of our state, he's in there mugging this guy and stealing his wallet, it would be very difficult to process that that individual is the governor. You might know it in your head, but it would be very hard to make that connection because in the context, that's just not what you expect him to do. So I think what Paul means here is that what Ananias did in totally flouting the Jewish law that he is supposed to be the prime upholder of and ordering them to hit Paul in the mouth when he hadn't started his defense yet had contradicted who he was. There's office so much that he couldn't think of him in terms of being the high priest. He momentarily didn't seem like he was the high priest, and so he addressed him like he was anybody else. That is my explanation. I may be in error, but that is the way that I best understand it. Now, what Paul had said was true. It was true. Ananias was a whitewashed wall or a whitewashed tomb. That's what Jesus compared the hypocrites to. And it was true that he would be struck down. He was killed. But it was not appropriate to say it in that way at that time. And this is something to remember when we're speaking to anyone. The fact that something is true or that it seems true at the time does not mean that it has to be said right then. And it does not mean that it has to be said to that person. It does not mean it has to be said to that way. In that way. There's time, place, and manner to these things. Some things never need to be said. So he didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong. But he looks at a different approach here, and he appeals to the scripture, and he says, yeah, you guys may be completely wrong. He doesn't say, you're right. He says, yes, it's true. The law says you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. He essentially apologized to people who were as wrong as they could be, but he wasn't stuck on, well, I may have been wrong, but you guys are much more wrong, so it doesn't matter. He dealt with what he could control. He wasn't responsible for what they did, but he was responsible for what he had said, and he immediately dealt with it. I think this is why he could say he lived in all good conscience. It's not that he never did anything wrong, but that he would immediately deal with it, face it, and move on and do something different afterward when he did something that was a mistake and got him on the wrong track. So he does not double down here. He does not, as we're wont to do, defend what he just did, saying, well, I know it was kind of wrong, but these guys are much wronger, and I'm going to ruin my witness to them. No, right's right, and wrong's wrong. He realizes that he messed up, and he turns, and he addresses it, and he fixes it, and then he's ready to move on. There is something that, it's a human effect. I think it has a name, but the name is getting away from me right now, where you make one mistake, I'm becoming flustered about that. You make another one much worse. There's a famous incident of an airline pilot who, he was a crackerjack airline pilot, the best pilot that his airline had, and he started to take off without permission. And his co-pilot said, wait a minute, we don't have permission. And about 2 minutes later, he took off again, and he hit another plane and killed 540-something people. This was the crash at Tenerife in the Canary Islands. No one knows what was going through his head because everyone, he and his co-pilot and everyone in his plane died. A few people survived on the other plane. But it is theorized that having made one relatively small mistake and not closed the books on that, he proceeded to make a bigger one. So when things start to go wrong, you know, when they say when you find yourself in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging. And Paul knew when to stop digging. We're going to mess up in a direction sometime. And we can't let that define the rest of the conversation. We stop, deal with the mess up, and then we move on in another direction that's right. So the way he went here was, again, a very intelligent move, starting on verse 6. When Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God." Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might have been pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them, and bring him into the barracks. So this is not how Paul started out. What he does here is purely a self-defensive maneuver. I don't think it really benefits anyone. He realizes that this trial is rigged against him because they're not even letting him get it started on his defense. And so he basically throws a bomb, as it were. He knows that there's two groups that don't like each other. It's like being in a room full of Republicans and Democrats. Well, if you yell yay for Donald Trump, you've at least got half the room on your side. And then maybe they'll all start fighting the Democrats and you can get away in the confusion. That's kind of the situation he had here. That is not the sort of thing he wanted to do, though, because that's not how he started out. He could have totally started with this, avoided getting cracked in the mouth, and had the same result. But he wanted to give a useful testimony. He wanted to reach people. He was trying to use his credibility, everything they knew about him, to get them to listen. It's only when he realized, okay, they're not going to listen, I just need to get out of here alive, that he pulled a technique which he seems to be a little conflicted about later. He says, they have absolutely nothing on me, except I did turn them against each other the other day in the council. So he was a little bit conflicted about doing it. But he was exercising wisdom, and the Bible does not say he was wrong in doing it. And it did have good fruit. I think we can take an application for it today. I'm going to get that a little later. I don't think that causing trouble between other groups of people is generally something we ever do deliberately. The Bible teaches us to be sowers of peace. If you're in a life and death situation, it's a bit different. But there are everyday applications that are a bit different on that too, that we'll get to in a bit. So starting back on verse 11, "But the following night the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome.' And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we are ready to kill him before he comes near.' So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, 'Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him.' So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, 'Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you.' And the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked privately, 'What is it that you have to tell me?' And he said, 'The Jews have agreed to ask you that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you.' So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, 'Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me.'" This is a really long way of saying that the Jews are trying to kill Paul. His nephew found out about and told the commander. He goes into a lot of detail here. Why does he do that? I think, and we talk about this sometimes, that when you get to accounts that seem like they are more detailed than they need to be, It's part of the verification that the account is true. If you read myths, they're very light on detail. Like you take Noah's Ark versus Utnapishtim's boat, for example. Utnapishtim's boat is a cube. Cubes don't float. They certainly don't float in storms. Noah's Ark, on the other hand, is dimensioned like a ship. Like ships even are dimensioned today in some designs. So Luke is very meticulous. People hate Luke for this and have been trying to poke holes in him since the start. He's very meticulous and he records exactly what was said and done. What I'm impressed with in this part of the incident, I mean, God is taking care of Paul. Circumstances are working for his good. This is what the Lord promised him. I'm really impressed with this young man. He's not named, but he's probably just a boy because of the way that the commander, you know, you don't generally take a 20-year-old by the hand and lead him into the other room. That's very weird behavior. He was probably 10, 11, 12 years old, something like that. He is, though, so mature and responsible. He hears some important news. He goes to the right person. He repeats the story accurately. It's 40 people or slightly more than 40 people. He says it's 40 people or slightly more than 40 people. He gives it detail for detail, as it should be. And he can be trusted not to go and tell everyone else what he knows. These sound like basics, but I think I've probably failed in every area of those qualifications myself. And so even though we don't know his name, this is an example of someone that the Lord can use for a very important role. If he doesn't do this, Paul might die. And it's because he has a day-to-day character, responsibility, that he is credible, he is careful. And these are things that we can learn from if we also want to be available and suitable to be used in those situations. So moving on to verse 23. And he called, referring again to the commander, he called for two centurions, saying, prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night, which is about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. He wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason why they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him, deserving of death or chains. And when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So that's as far as we're going to go in the passage today. It's worth noting, and this actually, again, affirms the historical reliability of the account, that what Luke says happened is contradicted in one slight point by what Claudius writes in his letter. Luke tells us that he didn't know Paul was a Roman citizen until after he rescued him from the mob. Claudius sort of burnishes it a bit by saying that he knew he was a Roman citizen before he rescued him. He's doing this because he is in danger still of being charged with having bound Paul. And so he wants to be sure that his reputation for really looking out for those Roman citizens is burnished. And that is also the reason that he is so, or the very likely reason it's not stated, that he is so enthusiastic about sending half the army with Paul to make good and sure nothing happens to him. It is simple self-interest on his part, so that he can demonstrate to his higher-ups that he is not mistreating citizens, and far from it, he's going to move heaven and earth to make sure this individual is safe. So we have a very interesting picture here. The Romans were never super friendly to Christians. They considered Christians to be, this is going to sound really weird, but they considered Christians to be idolaters or irreligious. They thought of them in the same terms as they thought of atheists, because to the Romans, the emperor was a god, and there were lots of gods, and you had to appease them. And these stupid Christians believed in only one God who wasn't even visible and worshipped this guy who had been crucified, which was the most disgraceful thing that could happen to anybody. So they thought of them as upside-down, stupid, backward, impediment-to-society type of people. They didn't like them. They didn't always kill them on sight, but they tended to blame them when things went wrong and persecute them from time to time, sometimes very, very brutally, and often exclude them from society. But here you have one of these Romans, one of these Christians not liking Romans, who is sending about, 300 or 400 soldiers at great expense to guard a Christian missionary to get him to his next stop. This is not something human wisdom can put together. God gives us resources for living our lives, and that's why he doesn't just tell us, now be sure you pray and I'll work everything out for you. He does. We're to pray without ceasing, and he will work everything out. But he says, be wise, be harmless. Be wise and be harmless. He'll give us the wisdom, but we have to use it. He'll give us the ability to be harmless and wise, but we have to do it. And to be able to do that, we go to his word to find out what it looks like. What did Paul have to work with here? One thing he had was his political freedom. He did not draw his freedom like a gun to protect himself every time. He used it to protect himself here, but back in chapter 16, he seemed to use it to protect others at his own cost. Paul had the attribute, which Zach called in his teaching on the six rules, of flexibility. He called it mobility, or flexibility, the ability to change tracks. Persistence, endurance, is a fruit of the Spirit. Stubbornness is not. And the two look somewhat similar. But one is driven by love, and the other is driven by self. Stubbornness is just a matter of, I can't be wrong, and I want what I want, so I'll never admit I was wrong, and I'll just keep saying I was right over and over again, and doubling down until the other person gets tired of asking. Persistence is, this is hard, but I'm going to keep doing it because this is what God has for me. It's the path of love for the other person. We want to be found being persistent and enduring. We do not want to be found being stubborn. Every moment of stubbornness after we have messed up especially makes it worse and harder to deal with afterwards. So we want to turn around and immediately deal with it, just like Paul did. He used the fact that his opponents were divided. Now, I told you earlier I was going to talk about an application of this. I do not think dividing your opponents in general is a good evangelistic technique. Getting people knocking each other's heads in, physically speaking, or starting an outright argument between them is probably not very helpful most of the time. However, there's something called deconstruction that we talk about in apologetics. And it means you show another person the flaws in their worldview, and eventually their worldview collapses, so it can be replaced with Christian worldview. And the way, one way that you do that is through contradictions. So most worldviews that exclude God are internally inconsistent. So you'll have a man whose moral sense over here tells him that murder is wrong, but whose logical sense over here cannot find a reason murder really should be wrong if there's no ultimate authority to say it is. And so when you do apologetics with that person, you constantly bring him back to the fact, okay, you know in your heart this is wrong, yet your mind cannot tell you how it could be wrong if there's no authority to say it's wrong. And you show those conflicts. You can also show conflicts among different viewpoints on things like the origin of the earth, things that set themselves up against God's word. We don't divide people, but we can use that to show the divisions in their own viewpoints that cause them to see there's only one key that fits every lock, and it is not human wisdom with its internal contradictions at all. And the last thing that Paul had to call on here was help from others. This is one reason we don't be lone wolves. We have a church family. We have people who know what's going on in our lives, so that when we need them, or when they need us, we're there for each other, and we already know what's going on. And we also surround ourselves with the right kind of people. We want to know reliable people. We want to know trustworthy people. We want to walk with people that we can call on, as well as people who may need some help from us. So I want to talk, I was going to put this in the middle because it's in the middle of the chapter, but I want to go back to it because this is what we want to leave this with. If we leave the story and we say, man, that Paul was clever, I wish I was clever like Paul, then we will have the wrong message. What is the most important part of this story? Well, I think it's in verse 11. When the Lord stood by Paul and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness at Rome. That has a lot of implications. It's kind of like when Jesus said to the disciples, we're going to the other side of the sea. They might have known that the storm, they'd somehow get through the storm if they had truly taken that to heart, because Jesus said, we're going to the other side of the sea. So here Jesus has told Paul, essentially, you can't be killed, at least until you get to Rome. I'm telling you that. You're not going to die before then. You'll be okay, and you'll be in condition to testify when you get there. What does this tell us? What it tells us is that all the events in our lives, including the ones that you might say we bring about through cleverness, are brought about by God's sovereignty. I mean, who made us clever in the first place? Who gives us wisdom to get through circumstances? It's Him. And he usually doesn't work solely through the wise behavior that he gives us to exercise, as in this incident, many things happened, such as the nephew overhearing the plot against Paul, which he could not have brought about with any amount of cleverness. What is the danger of cleverness? The danger of cleverness is that we begin to trust in it, to say, well, wasn't I smart? Didn't I show them? And then when we do that, we can no longer have wisdom. Cleverness is not wisdom. The wisdom comes from above. And if we're in the way of it, thinking, well, I'll just figure my way out of this, then we're not going to have divine wisdom, and we're going to be back to operating in the realm of the world, trying to beat up the wolf on our own. So in the midst of being wise, we always have to remember reliance on the Holy Spirit. He gives us the tools to use, but as we use them, we remember we are also His tool in His hand. And if the Lord does not orchestrate our circumstances, we are not going to be able to fix our situation. And we must also keep in view to fight the right war. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. People are not our enemies. People are not our opponents. Satan is our opponent. People are his slaves. Our goal is not to harm them or defeat them, but to set them free. And that's why the Lord has called us not to lay down other people's lives to fulfill our rights, but to lay down our lives so that eternal life can be brought to them because of life.